The Nightingale Conan Corporation presents Perfect Health with Dr. Deepak Chopra. Dr. Chopra has been hailed as a pioneer in the medicine of the future. He was born and raised in India, where he studied medicine. In 1971, he came to the United States for advanced training, and soon after built a large endocrinology practice in Boston. He is a fellow of the American College of Physicians and the former chief of staff of the New England Memorial Hospital in Stoneham, Massachusetts. Dr. Chopra combines his knowledge of Western science with his understanding of healing techniques from the Eastern tradition of Ayurvedic medicine. In this breakthrough program, he touches on the reality that lies beyond our current ideas of health and well-being. You'll learn what makes the mind-body connection magical, including how to reestablish your connection to the universe by heightening your level of awareness, how to take control over your own well-being by learning to listen to what your body wants and needs. You'll learn how to create balance in the body by enhancing sensory perception. You'll discover how and why you have the opportunity to renew yourself each day, how to retard the aging process and reduce stress, and you'll learn a practical system for improving the quality of your life at a very profound level.
Health is not just the absence of a disease. It's a joyfulness that should be inside us all the time. It's a state of positive well-being, which is not only physical, but emotional, and ultimately even psychological and spiritual. We all need to be healed in the highest sense by making ourselves perfect in mind, body, and spirit. The first step is to realize that this is even possible. The power asleep in all of us doesn't awaken until we call. To become familiar with the miracle of the human body and the human mind is to acquire awesome power. This power is magical because it literally allows us to create new bodies, more perfect, more flexible, more fluid, more dynamic, more creative, and long-lasting than we had ever imagined. To do that, we first have to understand, what is this thing that we call the body? What is this thing that we call the mind? Our traditional ideas of the human body-mind, or the human body and the mind, are based on very obsolete notions. We can call it a materialistic superstition almost. We think of the human body as a frozen sculpture fixed in space and time, as a physical machine that has somehow learned to think. So our approaches traditionally are also in the form of magic bullets. If you can't believe you ate the whole thing, all you have to do is take a couple of Alka-Seltzer. If you can't go to sleep at night, all you have to do is take a sleeping pill. It's supposed to cure your insomnia. If you're feeling anxious, take a tranquilizer. It's supposed to give you tranquility. You have an infection, take an antibiotic. It's supposed to get rid of the source of infection, and so on and so forth. These approaches do work to some extent. They're symptomatic approaches. Sometimes they interfere with the mechanisms of disease, but they're not the origins of disease. And in order to really understand what are the origins of the imbalances that are created in the body that ultimately result in malfunction, aging, what scientists also call entropy, which means running down, in order to understand that, we have to really understand the body as it really is. The body is not a frozen sculpture, it's a river of energy and information. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus said, you cannot step into the same river twice because new water is flowing in. And like that, the real you cannot step into the same flesh and bones twice because in every second of your existence, you're in fact creating a new body. And we can take a number of processes like breathing, eating, digestion, metabolism, most fundamentally thought, which is a fluctuation of energy and information in this body. Just take any one of these and you'll see how dramatically and how rapidly and how effortlessly and how efficiently we renew our bodies in every second of our existence. take breathing, for example. With each breath that you inhale, you take in 10 to the power of 22 atoms that ultimately end up as your heart cells, your kidney cells, your bone cells, your DNA, your brain cells. With each breath that you exhale, you're breathing out, literally, bits and pieces of your tissues and organs, and you're exchanging them with everybody else on this planet. Right now, for example, in your physical body, you have 1 million atoms that were once in the body of Christ, or Leonardo da Vinci, or Michelangelo, or Genghis Khan, or Mahatma Gandhi. With each breath, you take in the body of the universe into you. With each breath, you exchange your body with the body of the universe. In fact, calculations show, radioactive isotope studies show, that you replace 98% of all the atoms in your body in less than 1 year. You make a new liver every 6 weeks, a new skeleton once every 3 months, a new stomach lining every 5 days, a new skin once a month. Even the brain cells that you think with as physical atoms, they weren't there last year. And the DNA, the genetic material which holds memories of billions of years of evolutionary time, as raw material, it wasn't even there 6 weeks ago. So if you think you are your physical body, you really have a dilemma. Which one are you talking about? The 1990 model is not the same as the 1989 model, or even the model from 3 months ago. There is a deeper reality to the body. And that deeper reality is what we want to see. Because from that deeper reality comes both the mind and the body. Both come from that deeper level of existence. So let's try and see the body from that angle. If you asked a physicist, well, tell me what this body is made up of, he would say, it's made up of atoms. You say, well, what are these atoms made up of? He'd say they are particles that are moving at lightning speeds around huge empty spaces. They emerge from something which is just a field of pure potentiality, just a field of pure energy. And from that field, these particles emerge. They are fluctuations of energy and information. They emerge from a void. They rebound, collide, and then disintegrate into the void. So if you could see the body as it really is through the eyes of a physicist, you'd see a huge empty void with a few scattered dots and spots and some random electrical discharges here and there. And the question is, what is the nature of this void? Is it an emptiness of nothing, or is it a fullness of some non-material energy and information? Physicists are telling us today that, in fact, 99.9999% of our body is mostly empty space. And out of that empty space come these particles. And these particles aren't material objects. They are fluctuations of energy and information. So just like we say in common language, a quantum unit of light is a photon, a quantum unit of gravity is a graviton, a quantum unit of electricity is an electron, a quantum unit of the mind-body connection is a thought. But it's not even just a simple thought. It's a feeling, it's an emotion, it's a desire, it's an instinct, it's a drive, it's a notion, it's a concept, it's an idea. And it's not verbal. It's just that faint impulse that you experience all the time in your awareness that motivates you to drink a glass of water or walk from here to there. Therefore, we can use the word impulse of intelligence. At very primordial, basic levels, a thought is just an impulse of information. And it comes from our own consciousness. As we think, then we are making molecules. And these molecules are being generated not only in our mind or in our brain cells, they're being generated in our whole body. In other words, to think is to practice brain chemistry. And in the last 10 years or so, there's been some fascinating research that shows how literally true this is. When we have a thought or a feeling or an emotion, then in our brains, we make a set of chemicals known as neuropeptides. Neuro because they're found in the brain, peptides because they're protein-like molecules. And this is how brain cells speak to each other, not in the English language with a California accent or an Indian accent, but in the language of these chemical messengers from inner space. And scientists tell us that there are receptors to these chemical messengers on the surface of cells. So a brain cell, when it wants to speak to another brain cell, it manufactures these neuropeptides that then go and latch on to the receptor sites on the other brain cells. Now, what is really fascinating is that there are receptors to these chemical messengers, not only in brain cells, but in other parts of our body. For example, cells of the immune system, which protect us from cancer and infectious disease and degenerative disorders. These cells of the immune system, which scientists call monocytes and T cells and B cells, they have receptors to these chemical messengers, which are the material equivalent of thought. In other words, you can't have an idea or a notion or a thought or a feeling or a desire without your immune cells actually knowing about it. The immune cells are eavesdropping on your internal dialogue. They're literally listening to the conversation that you're having with yourself in every second of your existence. When you're dreaming, when you're thinking, when you're articulating, when you're just having the vaguest impulse of intelligence in your awareness, the immune cells are listening. Now, if that wasn't startling enough, what is even more startling is that the immune cells can make the same chemicals that the brain makes when it thinks. Now, if that's true, then the immune cells are thinking cells. They're conscious little beings. They have their own ideas, their own notions, their own intellect, their own emotions. Now, this might sound very esoteric to you, but it's a scientific fact. Go to a good neurobiologist and tell him to tell the difference between the immune system and the nervous system, and he'll say the immune system is just a circulating nervous system. So we have a thinking immune system. That's really remarkable. It is a thinking system. It knows how to discriminate between a friendly bacterium or an unfriendly bacterium, between a carcinogen and a harmless chemical, and it's moving around in the body. It may not be verbally as elite as your brain cell in that it doesn't think in English, but nevertheless, it's thinking. Now, what is even more startling is that when scientists start looking elsewhere in the body, they find that there are receptors to these chemicals that are the equivalent of thought in other parts, in stomach, in intestine, in colon, in kidney, and so on. Not only are there receptors to these chemicals, but the stomach cells, colon cells, other cells can make the same chemicals that the brain makes when it thinks. So now when you say, I have a gut feeling about such and such, you're not speaking metaphorically, you're speaking literally, because your gut makes the same chemicals that your brain makes when it thinks. In fact, your gut feeling may be a little more accurate because the gut cells haven't yet evolved to the stage of self-doubt. What I'm trying to say is that we have a thinking body. And you can't imprison the mind in the brain. That's an old notion, that the mind is confined to the brain. The mind is in every cell of our body. So when you say, I have a sad heart, or I'm bursting with joy, you're speaking literally, because that's what's happening at the chemical level, at the most fundamental level in a cell. I'll give you a couple of examples to show how this is really true. Let's say you have the experience of tranquility. Whatever the cause of it, you're feeling tranquil inside, then your body makes Valium, just like the one that Hoffman LaRoche makes, only it doesn't make you feel like a zombie. This is the real material equivalent of tranquility. When you feel anxious, your body makes jittery molecules, and they're not just made from the adrenal gland, they're made everywhere in the body. Each cell of the body is making jittery molecules, adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol, etc. Now, it turns out that when you feel exhilarated, whatever the reason for the exhilaration, your body makes very powerful immunomodulators, they're called. They're, in fact, anti-cancer drugs. They're known as interleukins and interferons. Recently, interleukins were used, for example, in the treatment of cancer. They're very expensive. A full course of interleukin 2 might cost you something like $40,000 for a full treatment. But you go on Magic Mountain on Disney World, you can make billions of dollars, millions of dollars worth of interleukin-2. But that is, of course, given the fact that that's your idea of fun. If your idea of fun is that magic ride, then you'll make interleukin-2. On the other hand, if you interpret that as not a good experience, then your body will make harmful chemicals. In other words, the interpretations of reality that we make to ourselves are generating from inside us all kinds of drugs. We have a pharmacy here that is absolutely exquisite. It makes everything. It makes tranquilizers, sleeping pills, anti-cancer drugs, immunomodulators, antibiotics, you name it, the body can make it in the right dose, at the precise time, for the right target organ, no side effects, and all the instructions are contained in the packaging. We are now coming to a very startling conclusion that the human body is actually a body-mind at the same time. You can't separate the two. The body is the mind at the same time. You can't confine the mind to the brain. And as we go through this tape series, you'll see that you can't even confine the mind to your physical body because it extends beyond your physical body into the whole universe. We are part of a thinking, conscious universe that is basically a non-local field of information. We can call the universe a non-local field of information and energy with which this local expression, which we call the physical body, is exchanging energy and information. And we're doing that, as I said, in every second of our existence. The only thing is we're doing it unconsciously. So we're doing it unconsciously. We create the same energy patterns, the same force fields that give rise to the same looking body year after year. Imagine you could change the bricks of this building once a year. But if you were stuck with the notion through force of habit or because you didn't know any better, that this was the only way to do the building. So you'd put the bricks in the same places year after year, you'd get the same kind of body. And you'd have the notion that it's supposed to age. Well, that notion would also translate into those energy patterns. So unconsciously, we're doing this in every second of our existence, creating the same energy patterns. It's estimated, for example, that the average person thinks about 60,000 thoughts a day. Now that's not surprising. What's a little disconcerting is that 95% of the thoughts you have today are the ones that you had yesterday. So you keep creating the same patterns that give rise to the same physical expression of the body. If you go to a deeper level, witness the whole process, become conscious of it, then you'd realize that in fact there are choices here. You could do wonderful things with this body. You could evoke the healing response from within because, in fact, you have the drugs, the appropriate drugs. You could restructure your perception of time, which would completely restructure the physical expression of the body. So it would be possible even to reverse or retard the aging process. We are not the body, nor are we the mind. We are the one who has the mind and the one who has the body. That level of existence is called consciousness, and it's that empty space. 99.999% of our body is mostly empty space. And from that field, literally, and scientists now call that the unified field, because it's the field of the whole universe, from that field emerge thoughts and feelings, emotions, that then become the molecules of the body, the physical body with its senses through which we perceive the universe. In fact, in the universe out there is a chaos of energy soup. And what we do is we take that chaos of energy soup, we ingest it through our five senses, and then we convert that into a physical reality in our own awareness, in our own consciousness. And we do it unconsciously most of the time. That results in certain interpretations that are part of a cultural indoctrination, I might say. And other scientists have used other terms. They say the hypnosis of social conditioning. So basically, as a result of conditioned responses, we structure a certain perceptual reality that results in a certain mode of expression. If we could go behind that, witness the whole process, then we'd know that, in fact, that's only one way of doing it. There are infinite choices here. When we experience complete silence in our body, then we recognize that, in fact, we are not the thought, but the one who's having the thought. When you say, I have a doubt about such and such, that implies a doubter. That doubter is who you are. That's behind the thought, that silent witness behind the thought. There's been that silent witness when you were a little girl or a little boy. It was there when you were an adolescent. It's there when you're an older person. There's one part of you that doesn't change. If you find that part of you that doesn't change, then you'll be able to cause transformations in that part of you that does change. The physical body changes, feelings and emotions change, the psychological makeup changes. But who's going through that experience? That's you. That we can call consciousness or the unified field. And that, you know, there's an ancient saying from India, from one of the old texts, which says, that part of your body, fire cannot burn, wind cannot dry, water cannot wet. Weapons cannot cleave, because it's timeless, it's spaceless, it's beyond all this. To get in touch with that deeper reality is to begin to get the real experience of who you really are. The whole body is a field of information. When you encounter a bacterium, for example, even though you haven't ever encountered that bacterium before, your DNA remembers the first time a human species encountered that bacterium in the whole evolutionary history of mankind, and then makes the precise antibody for that bacterium. That's intelligence. Intelligence is basically information. And in fact, our whole body is that field of intelligence, and it displays some extraordinary qualities that the human intellect doesn't even come close to. One of those is infinite correlation. Let me explain to you what infinite correlation means. It means to be able to do an infinite number of things at the same time and correlate them with each other. A human body, for example, can think thoughts and play a piano and digest food and kill germs and make a new baby and hypothesize a new philosophy all at the same time and correlate these activities with each other. At the same time as it's doing that, it's monitoring the movement of stars, because the body's biological rhythms, what we call circadian rhythms and seasonal rhythms, are in fact an expression of the rhythms of the earth. As the earth moves on its own axis, we have the cycles of night and day that cause very distinct changes in your body that you experience as biological rhythms. When those are disrupted, for example, you have the experience of jet lag. Or if you're working a night shift, even though you rest during the day, you don't feel quite right because your biological rhythms are out of tune with the cosmic rhythms. Or as the seasons change, as the earth moves around the sun, then those cause physical changes also in the body. So you fall in love in spring or get depressed in winter. These are distinct biochemical changes that are occurring as a response of the earth moving around the sun. Even the tides have an effect on our biological rhythms, because we have an ocean inside us which is identical to the ocean outside us. To just separate us from the rest of the planet is an artifact of sensory experience. It's something that comes from misperception of things as they really are. So you see, the body is displaying this quality of infinite correlation, which means the mind is everywhere, all at the same time, correlating these activities. Now, if I said the mind is omniscient, it would sound sort of mystical, that it knows everything, it's omnipotent, it's omnipresent. I mean, it would sound almost like, you know, I'm talking in mystical terms. But in fact, in scientific terms, that's an accurate statement, because the mind is everywhere, it is powerful, it is correlating all these activities with each other, What could be more dramatic as an example of omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence? Now, to realize that is to acquire a new definition of mind, not just these simple intellectual ideas that we have. That's only a very superficial expression of the mind. The real expression of the mind is this intelligence that pervades every cell, that correlates all the activities with each other, that is at the same time very powerful, because even below the level of our conscious awareness, it's doing all these activities and correlating them with each other. So it's really a non-local field of information. Non-local meaning you can't confine it here or there or here or there. That was an old idea, that the mind is in the brain. It's not in the brain, it's in every cell of our body. It's part of a larger mind. Now, once we recognize that, then we'll automatically, in fact, even to have the insight is to begin to cause transformations in your body. A person's body is nothing but an expression of all the ideas they have about it. If they have ideas that it's a physical machine, it's supposed to age in such and such way, it gets imbalanced because of environmental changes, and all these ideas, as we saw earlier, translate literally into chemical changes in the body. So the body that we experience normally is all our ideas about it. If those ideas changed, and they would change according to the latest discoveries in science, then just that change in the view of the body, just that change in the conceptual notion of the body would spontaneously cause transformations in the physical body. In other words, a mutation in consciousness would cause mutations in biology. If there's a fluctuation that changes at deeper levels of energy and information, then it causes spontaneously, without your having to do anything. You don't have to brainwash yourself about this. You just have to have the insight. And the insight itself causes the changes. We tend to believe that our senses are the crucial test of reality. That's our current worldview. But we know that's not true anymore. I mean, my senses tell me the earth is flat. I don't believe that. My senses tell me that it's stationary, and I know it's hurtling through outer space at thousands of miles an hour and spinning on its own axis at dizzying speeds. My senses tell me that it's solid. Well, that's not true either. The fact is that it's mostly quantum fluctuations in empty space. But that empty space is not a emptiness of nothing, it's a fullness of non-material intelligence. You get in touch with the intelligence, and there you are. You have a completely new reality of the body, and also a completely new experience of the body. You begin to experience it as more fluid, more dynamic, more creative, more changing. You're changing your physical body more effortlessly, more rapidly, more efficiently than you can change your clothes. The body is a field of ideas. That's what it is. And these are ideas that we've made to ourselves. Literally, it's a field of ideas. So the intellectual understanding, the insight, will spontaneously cause the changes. Several years ago, doctors discovered an effect which subsequently became known as the placebo response. They would give people pills and they'd say these are supposed to kill your pain. And a certain number of patients, approximately 30%, would have relief of their pain. Now, what was later discovered was that you could block the placebo response by giving them an injection of something called Narcan, which is a narcotic antagonist. And this led to the conclusion that when we have this so-called placebo response, what we're really doing is making in our bodies chemicals that are more powerful than any heroin you could buy on the street. In simplicity, you didn't use any affirmations, you just had a simple notion, this is going to relieve my pain. And it did so by making these very powerful chemicals. Later on, it was discovered that these so-called placebo responses occur not only in pain syndromes, but in other conditions. So you give somebody a pill and you say, this is going to relieve your heart disease, and they have that simple notion in their awareness as a true idea, then they make a chemical that has the effect of lowering the blood pressure and improving the blood flow to the heart. Placebo responses occur in cancer sometimes when they result in so-called spontaneous remissions. What is the mechanism? Well, the body makes these anti-cancer drugs as a result of that simple notion that this, what I'm taking, is an anti-cancer drug. Now, just like there are placebo responses, there are the opposite of that, so-called nocebo responses. It's when a patient walks into a doctor's office and the doctor says, Mrs. Smith, I'm sorry to tell you, but you have breast cancer. It has metastasized to all these bones, and you have only 6 months to live. Now, if Mrs. Smith happens to be a simple person who believes everything her doctor tells her, then she translates that notion into that outcome. It's the opposite of the placebo response. It's the nocebo response. But basically, what is the placebo response? It's an interpretation one makes to oneself. And what's the nocebo response? Another interpretation that one makes to oneself also. So let's examine that at a deeper level, because these interpretations subsequently become memories. And then these memories trigger transformations spontaneously, even without our knowing it. A very interesting experiment was done once by Dr. Herbert Spector, who is a scientist at the National Institute of Health. And he did a very interesting experiment. He took some mice and he gave them injections of a chemical called poly-IC. This stimulates the immune system. So he gave them injections of this poly-IC and he had them smell camphor at the same time. After a while, all they had to do is smell camphor and they make all these powerful drugs in their body that are anti-cancer drugs. They stimulate the immune system. He took another group of mice and he gave them something called cyclophosphamide, which destroys the immune system. Then he had them smell camphor at the same time, and then they just smell camphor and they destroy the immune system. So you have two groups of mice now, one that smells camphor and stimulates the immune system, one that smells camphor, destroys the immune system. You can load up one set of mice with bacteria or carcinogens, nothing will happen to them. The other mice, they have a faint whiff of bacteria in the air and they get pneumonia. We expose them to carcinogens, they get cancer. What's the crucial difference between these mice that results in either death or life is the memory of the smell of camphor and its interpretation. Now, where is that memory locked? Is it in the brain cells? Obviously not. It's even in the immune cells. In fact, the memories are encoded, are structured in every cell of our body. Our memories are constantly transforming themselves into physical reactions in our body. In other words, the way we interpret our experiences in every moment of our existence results in this printout which the body is. The body is just the printout. The hardware is the nervous system. The software is all these chemical changes that are occurring, the biochemistry of it. The programming is our own thoughts, feelings, emotions, desires, interpretations, ideas, concepts. But then there's a programmer. Who's the programmer? The programmer is the inner self. To get in touch with the programmer gives us then the ability to rewrite the program. I could give you one or two other very interesting experiments that are fascinating because I think they're very important to this intellectual understanding of the mind-body connection or the mind-body as an inseparable unit. In 1980, scientists at Ohio State University were studying the metabolism of cholesterol in rabbits. And they were feeding rabbits diets which were extremely high in cholesterol. And to their amazement, they found that there was one group of rabbits that didn't get the high cholesterol levels despite being given the same diet. And after they looked for all the variables, they found, in fact, that the only difference between these rabbits and the ones that were getting the high cholesterol levels and the hardening of the arteries was that the technician who was feeding these rabbits, instead of just throwing the food at them, he'd take them out of their cages and he'd pet them and cuddle them and kiss them and sing to them and speak to them. And that would result in a change in the peptides, in the neuropeptides in their brain cells and elsewhere in their body, that they would shunt the cholesterol into a different metabolic pathway. So they wouldn't get the high cholesterol and so on. Now, to my mind, this is an extremely important study. After all, heart disease kills more people in our culture than anything else. And the crucial determinants seem to be simple things like touching, petting, kissing, etc., speaking. Now, there are some other fascinating experiments in human beings. There was a study done at the University of Miami where they took a group of premature infants. They call them preemies in medical language. And what they did was they had two groups, one a control group and the other an experimental group. In the experimental group, the investigator would reach out through a hole in the crib and stroke the preemie three times a day for about 10 minutes each. Just doing that, of course, the scientists didn't call it stroking. They called it kinesthetic tactile stimulation, which is the Orwellian scientific terminology for stroking. God forbid, call it love. But in any case, those babies that experienced this tactile kinesthetic stimulation, or flow of consciousness, or love, if you want to call it that, they gained an average of 49% more weight per day, given the same formula, the same diet. So there was something non-material which was influencing the level of growth hormone in their body that caused them to gain 49% more weight per day, fed on the same formula, leading the investigators to conclude that tactile kinesthetic stimulation is a cost-effective strategy because it saves $3,000 per admission. The babies can be discharged 5 days earlier. And most recently, in Massachusetts, the HEW, a few years ago, they did a study looking once again for risk factors for heart disease. And everybody, when you ask them what are the risk factors for heart disease, they say, well, smoking, hypertension, diabetes, being overweight, etc. Well, the fact is that more than 50% of people who have heart attacks don't have any of the usual standard risk factors. And as a result of this study, it was found that the two most important factors for heart disease, number one, job dissatisfaction, number two, what is called self-happiness rating, which means go out on the street, ask people two questions. Number one, are you happy? Number two, do you love your job? And if they can honestly say yes to both, they're probably going to be all right. A very astonishing fact is that more people die in our culture on Monday mornings. More people die in our civilization today on Monday mornings at 9 o'clock than any other time of the week. That's an astonishing, stunning accomplishment of which only the human species can take credit. Presumably, no other animal knows the difference between Monday and Tuesday. What is the difference? The difference is an idea, a notion, a thought. What Monday means to us, how we interpret it. And like that, how we interpret time, how we interpret space, how we interpret physical reality, literally determines our experience of physical reality, which includes the experience of the physical body. One of the things that influences how the body functions is our interpretation of our experience of time. Now, this is a very interesting facet of our biology. We tend to think that there is such a thing as time. But ask a physicist, is time a thing or a notion? Is time something that you can put your handle on, or is it just a concept to explain how we experience change in our environment? Sir Thomas Gold, who is a quantum physicist, a very eminent physicist of our time, he says, no experiment has ever been done that proves the existence of time. Time is a concept that we use to explain our experiences of change. In other words, time is an internal dialogue. That's why physicists no longer use the word time. They use the term space-time continuum, because time is a relative phenomenon. It's not an absolute. But how does that apply to us? Let me give you a few examples. The other day I took a flight from Boston to London, and I met this old friend of mine, and I was having such a good time that time flew. Okay, they told us that the flight took 6 hours or 7 hours, but for us it seemed like we were there, as the expression goes, in a jiffy. We were there in a few minutes. We forgot to sleep, we forgot to eat, we forgot to go to the bathroom. When we got there, we didn't even have jet lag. What happened? Well, as a result of that notion that time flew, our biology was also affected. The cycles of sleep and rest, the cycles of appetite, the cycles of elimination, these are distinct biological functions, and even the experience of jet lag wasn't there. As a result of this faint notion that time was flying. Or you come across people, particularly in our society, who say, I'm running out of time. Okay, they have 10 deadlines to meet. So they're constantly trying to beat time, so to speak. They watch the same clock that you and I watch or look at, but for them it's moving faster as a result of their internal perception of time. You measure such a person's biological responses, you'll find that their heart rate is faster, their growth hormone levels are higher, their insulin levels are higher, their blood sugar fluctuates much more, their blood pressure is higher, they have more arrhythmias per minute to their heart, and when they suddenly drop dead of a heart attack at a certain age, then time has run out. They've converted that internal experience of time running out into that physical experience of time running out. Meet another person and his internal dialogue, his perception, his interpretation is, I have all the time in the world. And you find that his heart rate is slower, his blood pressure is lower, his biological responses are much smoother, and he lives a longer time. Another person may have used the expression, we are all familiar with this expression, the beauty of the mountain was breathtaking, time stood still. Now watch the expression, the beauty of the mountain was breathtaking, time stood still. Because when time stands still, breath comes to a standstill. Breath and time are both the movement of thought. And when thought comes to a standstill, in a moment of unity, a peak experience, this is what Abraham Maslow called peak experiences. This is the whole reason for the existence of art, or why we listen to music, or why we enjoy nature. Because what happens is there are breathtaking moments when the beauty completely overwhelms us and thought comes to a standstill. And when thought comes to a standstill, then the experience of change in the body comes to a standstill. Breath stops and biological function goes to a level of silence from where we emerge. And in fact, the experience of entropy or aging stops in those moments. So all these experiences of time are literally interpretations in consciousness. There's an ancient saying in India, bliss is the effortless suspension of time in the moment of transcendence, in the moment of that unity experience, that peak experience. The Soviet writer Dostoevsky, he had great insight into the nature of the transcendent, this field of silence, the experience of bliss. In one of his passages in the book Possessed, one of his characters says, there are moments, you can reach moments when time suddenly stops and becomes eternal. And the other character asks him, do you hope to reach such a moment? And he says, I do. It's hardly likely in our time, the other character says. He says, no, when a man attains bliss, there will be no more time because there's no need for it. It's just a thought. He says, where will they hide time? He says, nowhere. Time is not a thing. Time is an idea. It will vanish from the mind. So again, to bring this back to practical terms, how we experience change, if we're always in a hurry, if we're always trying to beat time or compete with time, we are causing those physical changes in our body as well. On the other hand, if our interpretation of time is truer to reality, which is, in fact, that there's only an eternal present, because in the present we experience the past, in the present we anticipate the future. If we can stay with the present, then even the physical changes in the body will not occur that occur with the passage of time. There are many experiments that in fact show, and we'll get into them later when we discuss aging, that the way we interpret time completely influences very distinct biological changes in our body. So what I'd really like to do is to summarize our ideas about the quantum mechanical body. The body is made up of particles. Physicists have fancy names for them. They call them leptons, quarks, mesons, etc. These particles are not material objects. That's just the superstition we must get rid of. These particles are definitely not material. These particles give us the experience of matter through our senses, but they're really fluctuations of energy and information in a void of energy and information. And most of your body, more than 99.9% of it, is empty space. The empty space is not an emptiness of nothing, but a fullness or a reservoir of non-material intelligence, what we can call information, that is ultimately responsible for the material expression of both your body and your mind. Scientists may use terms to describe this essential ground of matter. They call it the unified field. Other scientists call it morphogenetic field. The term morphogenetic simply means, it comes from the Greek roots, morpho and genesis, which means to give rise to form and give birth to form and variety, the diversity that the body is. The essential point to grasp here is that your real nature is that you are mostly empty space, which scientists are now discovering to be a field of non-material intelligence or information. This is the essential you, stripped of all the superficial layers of both mind and body. The essential you, which is neither mind nor matter, but the source of both, being non-material is something you can be. That is, in fact, your ultimate ground. In other words, the real you is non-material. Therefore, it's not subject to the laws of matter, which are in the sphere of time, space, and causation. Your essence, your real essence, is a field of awareness that interacts with its own self and then becomes both mind and body. In other words, you are basically consciousness, which then conceives, governs, constructs, and actually becomes the mind and the body. At first, this may sound very strange and abstract, but as you bear with this notion and understand it, you'll realize the most dramatic discovery, and that is we are not physical machines that have learned how to think, we are thoughts that have learned how to create the physical machine. We are impulses of intelligence that have learned how to create the physical machine. We are quantum events in that field which has learned how to create both the mind and the body. With the understanding of the quantum mechanical body, what we are really doing is we are shifting into a new paradigm, not only of the human body, but of our very interpretation of nature itself. We think of the world out there as independent of us, whereas in fact it may be a construct of our own interpretations. The old paradigm says that there is an objective world out there which is completely independent of a perceiver. The new paradigm says we live in a participatory universe. The objective world is in fact a response of the observer. We create it. The old paradigm says that the material world, which includes human beings, is made up of clumps of matter which are separated from each other in space and time. The new paradigm says that the world is non-material, that it's composed of energy fields which come from one underlying unmanifest field, that space-time are part of this field. The old paradigm says that mind and matter are independent and separate entities. The new paradigm says that mind and matter are essentially the same. The field experienced subjectively is the mind. The field experienced objectively is the world of material objects. The old paradigm says that the mind is trapped in the brain, that intelligence is localized in the nervous system, or at most in the body. The new paradigm says mind is not trapped in the brain or even in the body. It extends far beyond the reaches of the cosmos. It's infinite and unbounded, although it might find expression in localized forms and phenomena. In fact, the whole universe is this field of intelligence. And when this field of intelligence thinks, interprets to itself, then the material world comes out as its expression. The old paradigm says that consciousness is the epiphenomenon of matter, which means we are physical machines that have learned how to think. The new paradigm says that matter is the epiphenomenon of consciousness. We are thoughts, quantum events in that unified field, impulses of intelligence that have learned how to create the physical machine. The old paradigm says that human beings are self-contained, independent entities. The new one says that human beings are not self-contained, but in fact focal points in this field of intelligence, that we are inseparably interconnected with the patterns of intelligence in the whole cosmos. In other words, we are a set of relationships. The old paradigm says that our bodies have well-defined edges. We are separate. Our needs are separate. The new paradigm says there are no well-defined edges to the body. We are not separate. Our needs are totally interdependent. Our bodies are a part of that changing, pulsating pattern. The old paradigm says time exists as an absolute. The new one says that time doesn't exist as an absolute. Only eternity does. Time is a perception of change. It's an experience of change. How we metabolize our experience of time brings about physiological changes in our body. What scientists call entropy and aging are in part expressions of how we metabolize or interpret time. The old paradigm says perception is an automatic phenomenon. The new one says, in fact, we learn how to interpret, and that brings about our perceptual experiences. And so on. So we're moving into a very major shift in the thinking, even of scientists, that see our bodies as an expression of a larger wholeness. Scientists started discovering this with the advent of quantum physics. There's a very well-known author by the name of George Gilder, who's a great interpreter of these notions and ideas, and he says, in the atom of information, this present era of science acquires its definitive symbol. What was once a blank solid is now revealed in part as information. What was once a particle now shines with patterns and probabilities. What was once opaque and concrete is now a transparent tracery of physical laws. And what are these physical laws? These are fluctuations in our own consciousness. It's a beautiful interpretation, and the interpretation that we are seeing evolving over the last 60 years with the advent of quantum physics. There's a great poem by an Indian poet written in the 1920s, Tagore. He won the Nobel Prize. I think it summarizes the whole new paradigm. And he says, "The same stream of life that runs through my veins runs through the world and dances in rhythmic measure. It is the same life that shoots in joy through the dust of the earth into numberless blades of grass and breaks into tumultuous waves of leaves and flowers. It is the same life that is rocked in the ocean cradle of birth and death, in ebb and in flow." And he says, "My limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life, and my pride is from the life throb of ages dancing in my blood this moment." To have that experience of the life throb of ages dancing in your blood this moment is the experience of ecstasy, the experience of joy, the experience of connectedness. That's the healing experience. The ancient wisdom is finding in science some very modern insights. The combination of this modern insight and ancient wisdom is really going to lead us into the knowledge of how to evoke that healing response from within. having seen and contrasted the old paradigm with the new paradigm, and having seen that the body is simply a printout from consciousness, let's see how we can make practical use of this knowledge. The knowledge I'm giving you is not something that I invented. It comes from thousands of years of very ancient tradition called Ayurveda. And the word Ayurveda has at its roots the two words, Ayus, which means life, Veda, which means knowledge. So basically the word Ayurveda means knowledge of life. And its basic principle is what we have already outlined. There's a very nice aphorism in Ayurveda. If you translate that into English, it goes somewhat like this. As is the atom, so is the universe. As is the human body, so is the cosmic body. As is the human mind, so is the cosmic mind. As is the microcosm, so is the macrocosm. So given that basic understanding, we'll see how this knowledge then gives us more knowledge of different body types, physiological responses, biological rhythms, gives us more knowledge of how we use our sensory experiences to bring about changes in our body. So to begin with, let's just take the first notion, which is very crucial to our understanding of the body in Ayurveda, and that is the understanding of physiological body types. It's very simple. I think we all understand that we are different from each other. We're different physically, emotionally, intellectually. Science today, for example, acknowledges that we possess what they call biochemical individuality. No two people have exactly the same level of cholesterol or the same level of iron in their blood. This is also true of our psychological makeup. We possess emotional individuality, intellectual individuality, psychological individuality. If we are to live easily, comfortably, effortlessly, without strain, then we must respect our uniqueness at all our levels, physical, emotional, intellectual. And understanding our body type helps us to do that. I'll give you just a few simple examples to show how that's true, for example. Let's say three people get stuck in a traffic jam. One person gets nervous and anxious. A second person gets angry and impatient. A third person switches on the radio and enjoys Mozart. What's the difference between these three body types? And how does it happen? This is what Ayurveda tells us. One person drinks three sips of coffee and his nerves get jangled. Another person downs three cups of black espresso and nothing happens. One person drinks orange juice and gets heartburn. Another feels refreshed. So when we are reacting to either food or a situation or a circumstance or a person or to the weather, we are actually responding to a signal that's coming from inside us. The signal may be in the form of comfort or discomfort, but if we could learn how to listen to these signals that are being sent to us all the time from within us, then we'd realize that these signals affect our moods, they affect our behavior, they affect our perceptions, our tastes, our habits, our attraction to other people, our appetites, our urges, and so on. So knowing your psychophysiological body type, as it's called, psycho because it's mind, and physiological because it's body, so knowing your, one might say, mind-body type allows you to tune into yourself, and of course, to others in your environment, so that once you're tuned in, then you can respond appropriately. Also, what happens is you become less a bundle of conditioned reflexes that's constantly being triggered by people and circumstance. Most people react in predictable ways. But once you know your body type, then you have a much more spontaneous control over your reactions to situations, circumstances, food, weather, etc. Every time there's an event in the mind, there's a corresponding event in the body. If you're afraid of the dark, for example, that fear takes the physical form of adrenaline shooting through your bloodstream. All our hopes, all our fears, the faintest wisps of emotion and desire have left their mark on our physiology. And these mental events are constantly shaping our body. Now, if you know the body type, then you can look at a person, and by looking at their physical body, you can have a good idea of the mental events that shape that physical expression. On the other hand, if you know how their mind works, then you can predict the kind of body they'll have. There's an ancient expression here in Vedic science, again in Ayurveda, which says, if you want to know what your mind was like in the past, then all you have to do is examine your body now. And if you want to know what your body will look like in the future, then you should examine your mind now, because the two are inseparably one. So basically, understanding of body type is very crucial now for us to understand how healing works and how we can interact with our environment, knowing our body type. There are approximately 10 different body types that come about as a result of different permutations and combinations of what are called, in technical language, they are called doshas. That's just a Sanskrit word for mind-body principles. There are three basic body types. The first is Vata, Vata, V-A-T-A. It governs movement. The second is called Pitta, P-I-T-T-A. It governs metabolism. The third is called Kapha, K-A-P-H-A. It controls structure. Now, each of us is a unique combination of these three basic principles, but one of them tends to dominate. So a Vata person displays certain characteristics. These are usually the following. A light, thin build. A Vata person performs activity very quickly. Their digestion and hunger is irregular. They usually have light, interrupted sleep. They're extremely enthusiastic people, vivacious by nature, very imaginative. Excitability is a predominant feature of these people, and changing moods. They are quick to grasp new information, but also quick to forget. They tend, when they are under stress, to worry a lot. They also have constipation as a predominant feature when they get stressed. They tire easily. They have a tendency to overexert, and their mental and physical energy comes in bursts. Now, if you know of somebody who says, I can eat anything I want and I don't gain weight, then they're a characteristic Vata. And you'll find that they're hyper-excitable. They move around a lot. They don't have much fat under their skin. They have prominent tendons and bony prominences are there. So people who display any one of these qualities, they're showing this aspect of movement that characterizes both their mind and their body. They may be hungry at any time of the day or night. They love excitement and constant change. They go to sleep at different times every night. They skip meals. Their habits are in general irregular. They digest food well one day, but maybe poorly the next day. They display bursts of emotion that are short-lived and easily forgotten. They walk quickly. Their movements show this aspect of movement. I think the main thing to understand is that even if we don't have all of these characteristics, if we display some of these, then we are displaying those Vata characteristics. And when they go out of balance, there are strategies that we can use to bring them back into balance. The Vata type is also called ectomorphic, traditionally. They have this characteristic of angular features, thin build, not gaining weight easily. The second body type, the Pitta type, that's more mesomorphic. They have a medium build. They have more strength and endurance than the Vata type. They usually are very enterprising people, like challenges. They have a very sharp intellect, but they also have sharp hunger and thirst and strong digestion. The kind of person who just can't wait when he's hungry. His stomach is growling all the time when he's hungry. He gets very stressed if he misses a meal. They have a tendency towards anger and irritability under stress. The Vata types, when they're under stress, they get anxious and they tend to worry. Whereas the Pitta types, anxiety is not a feature. The feature is anger and impatience. They also have a tendency to have freckles in their skin. They break out into acne quite easily. They have an aversion to hot weather. They have very precise, articulate speech. They're good speakers, orators. When a person is displaying any of the following features, he's acting his pitta out. When he feels very ravenously hungry, if dinner is even half an hour late, he gets stressed about that. Pitta people also live by their watch, usually resent having their time wasted. They wake up at night sometimes feeling hot and thirsty. They take command of situations, or at least feel they should. They learn from experience that others find them too demanding, sometimes sarcastic, sometimes critical. When you see them walking, you see them having a determined stride to their walk. So just by looking at a person walking, you can sometimes know this person has pitta tendencies. The kapha type, which is the third characteristic type, K-A-P-H-A, these are people who are endomorphic. In other words, they are the kind of people who might say, all I have to do is look at food and I gain weight. They have a real hard time losing weight. They have a solid, powerful build. They usually have a great deal of physical strength and endurance. They have steady energy. They're slow and graceful in action. They're usually the kind of people who are quite tranquil and relaxed. They have a relaxed personality. They're slow to anger. They don't show the features of anger that pitta displays or worry that vata displays. They just hold on to things, whether it's fluid or fat or relationships, whatever. They are slow to grasp new information but have a very good retentive memory. They usually have a very heavy, prolonged sleep. They have a tendency, as I said, to obesity. Their digestion is slow. Their hunger is mild. They're usually very affectionate, tolerant, and forgiving people. But when they become stressed, they tend to become possessive and even more complacent than they usually are. When people mull over things for a long time before making a decision, they're displaying a kapha tendency. It's very kapha, for example, to wake up slowly, lie in bed a long time, and need coffee when you're waking up in the morning. It's also kapha to be happy with things as they are, not really wanting to change too much. Kapha people respect other people's feelings, and they feel genuine empathy more frequently than, say, vata or pitta people. They seek emotional comfort, though, from eating, and that's why they tend to hold on to their weight. They have graceful movements, gliding walk, even though they are overweight. When you see a person gliding by, very gracefully, that's displaying a kapha tendency. Whether you are dominantly showing vata tendencies or showing pitta tendencies or kapha tendencies or a combination, for the first time, become a witness to the mind-body connection. Ultimately, we just do things spontaneously anyway, but now just being a witness of the common characteristics that we display under certain situations allows us to have a firmer grip on the mind-body connection as it pertains to us as unique individuals. It's important to understand that we are not trying to have a situation where we have same amount of vata, pitta, kapha. All we are trying to achieve is the correct balance, which is a unique thing for us as unique individuals. Also, it's important to understand that one particular dosha is not better than another. So it's not necessarily true that it's preferable to have vata or preferable to have kapha or preferable to have pitta. All you need to know is what are the tendencies you display under usual situations, what are the tendencies you display when you're under stress. And when you get to know yourself, then you have a better control, a firmer grip on your own nature, so to speak. So each of the body types has its own positive as well as its own negative attributes. The positivity comes out spontaneously when they're in balance. Vata people are imaginative, they're sensitive, they're spontaneous, they're resilient, they get exhilarated when they are feeling good. Pitta people are intellectual, confident, enterprising, joyous. Kapha people are calm, sympathetic, courageous, forgiving, loving. The negativity comes out spontaneously also when they're out of balance. So So if we have a pitta tendency, the pitta traits are more likely to get imbalanced. If we have a kapha tendency, then the kapha traits are more likely to get imbalanced. And so naturally we pay more attention to those, but ultimately there are only two signals that the universe gives us. One is a sense of comfort, and the other is a sense of discomfort. How to assess whether we are moving into balance? Just listen to the signals of comfort and discomfort in your body. When we are feeling uncomfortable, either physically or emotionally or even with an intellectual dilemma, then we are moving out of balance. And when we are feeling comfortable inside, then we are moving into balance. So we can understand that health is a state of balance. When you're healthy, then you're displaying this balance. And what do we mean by balance? To have the flexibility, both in the mind, in the body, to adjust to change. Perfect balance, infinite flexibility in the face of constant change. If you can maintain that, then spontaneously the positive attributes of each of the body types will emerge. And when those positive attributes emerge, then one feels joyous, one feels happy, and then spontaneously the body, which is nothing but happy molecules, happy thoughts, happy feelings, happy molecules coming out spontaneously, not through some mood making, not through some manipulation, but just spontaneously by virtue of being in balance. When there is imbalance, on the other hand, then that can result in a health problem. And there's always a reason for that. Let's say you begin to have a vata imbalance. Why does it happen? The usual reasons are one of the following things. You have been under stress recently and you reacted to it with anxiety. Or you have exhausted yourself physically or undergone a period of mental strain and overwork. When people with vata constitutions overdo things, then they easily go out of balance. Unlike, say, kapha people who have a lot of physical endurance. Vata people are much more prone to be affected, say, by cigarette smoking or by coffee or by drugs in general. They have exaggerated responses. Kapha people, not so much. If there's a sudden change in a person's life, or even the seasons are changing, the vata people are the kind of people who get the cold at the change of season much more frequently than the other types. And in fact, vata people get very easily imbalanced if they have a lot of cold food or raw food or dry food or iced beverages. Vata people also cannot skip meals easily. It takes its toll on their body. If they go on a stringent diet, vata people will have quickly the state of imbalance. Or if they sleep late, or they sleep poorly for even a few days, then they go into imbalance very easily. If they take frequent trips, they have jet lag much more frequently than other people. They suffer easily from things like grief, fear. Fear is a dominant emotion in vata people under stress. So mental indications of vata imbalance include worry, anxiety, an overactive mind, impatience, a loss of mental focus, short attention span, and sometimes depression. Behavioral indications of vata imbalance include insomnia, fatigue, inability to relax, restlessness, low appetite, and impulsiveness. And the physical indications are constipation, dry or rough skin, low stamina, loss of energy, intestinal gas, high blood pressure, back pain. Back pain is a frequent feature amongst vata people. Also, menstrual cramps, dysmenorrhea, premenstrual syndrome is a vata imbalance. Irritable bowel syndrome, chapped skin, or intolerance to cold and to wind, aching and arthritic joints, weight loss, acute pain anywhere, muscle spasms anywhere, these are all signs of vata imbalance. If you notice, they're all features of movement. Just like vata people, when they're stressed, they have certain things that happen to them. The same applies to, of course, pitta and kapha types. Pitta types get aggravated when they've been under stress and have reacted to it with suppressed anger or frustration or resentment. Pitta people also get imbalanced when they place excessive demands on themselves when they live under constant pressure from deadlines, cannot bear to waste time. Or Pitta people get aggravated when they eat hot, spicy food, or oily food, or fried food, or food that contains a great deal of salt. Their diet, if it contains a large amount of fermented things like cheese, vinegar, sour cream, or alcoholic beverages, if the weather is hot and humid, typical summer weather, it aggravates these Pitta tendencies. If you get fatigued or badly sunburned, that also brings out Pitta tendencies. And what are the indications that you have a Pitta imbalance? Anger, hostility, self-criticism, irritability, impatience, resentment. Behavioral indications of Pitta imbalance include outbursts of temper, argumentative stance, tyrannical behavior, sometimes criticism of others, intolerance of delays. These emerge as one goes into imbalance. So here, you see, it's a much more compassionate view of somebody's behavior, because you really don't have to criticize the behavior if you understand that it's basically a psychophysiological imbalance that can be easily corrected once you know what is causing that imbalance. Physical indications of Pitta imbalance include skin inflammations, boils, acne, excessive hunger or thirst, bad breath, hot flushes, heartburn, acid stomach, ulcers, sour body odors, and sometimes rectal burning, hemorrhoids. These are all features of Pitta imbalance. Now, the third body type is Kapha body type, and they, under stress, show certain other indications that reflect their state of imbalance. A serious Kapha problem, such as diabetes, allergies, or obesity, may frequently run in a family. That's a Kapha imbalance. So if you start to feel sick and the cause is Kapha imbalance, then there is a certain reason for that. And the reason could be that a serious Kapha problem, such as diabetes, allergies, or obesity, runs in the family. Or that you've gained a lot of weight and you feel depressed about it. If your diet contains large amounts of sugar, salt, fatty or fried foods, heavy foods, dairy products, especially cheese, milk, ice cream, these are all things that will aggravate a Kapha tendency. If you feel stressed and you react to it by withdrawing, feeling insecure or unwanted, then you're displaying a Kapha tendency also. If you place excessive emphasis on possessing, storing and saving things, that also then results in Kapha imbalance, which is reflected in physiological changes in the body. If you act dependent or overprotective in relationships, a Kapha tendency. If you sleep late more than a few days in a row, that may also aggravate a Kapha tendency. And cold, damp weather, snowy weather, typically winter and spring weather, also bring that tendency out. These are the people who get depressed in winter, for example. Mental indications of Kapha imbalance are dullness, mental inertia, laziness, stupor, depression, over-attachment. Behavioral indications, procrastination. People delay things all the time. They're unable to accept change. They tend to get greedy or oversleep or get heavy or their movements become much slower. Physical indications include intolerance to cold and damp weather, sinus congestions, runny nose, fluid retention in tissues, bloating, chest congestion, skin becomes pale, loose and aching joints may occur. High cholesterol is a typical Kapha imbalance. These are people really have to watch their diet, because even the slightest change, their cholesterol shoots up. They experience heaviness in limbs, frequent colds, as I mentioned, weight gain, allergies, asthma, cough, cysts in their bodies. The key is to understand what are the tendencies you are prone to. Knowing what those tendencies are when you are under stress and knowing the kinds of imbalance they can create then allows you to use the knowledge of Ayurveda very effectively to create balance again in your physiology. And there are four broad areas of everyday life that can be used to promote balance. These include diet, exercise, daily routine, and what is called seasonal routine. balancing vata, for example, can be done through just regular habits or the experience of quiet, silence, attention to fluids, decreased sensitivity to stress, ample rest, warmth. Just taking a warm shower, for example, is a very effective way of balancing vata. Or doing a hot sesame oil massage is a very useful way of balancing vata. Making sure that you eat at regular intervals is a very effective way of restoring vata. Restoring pitta can be done by cooling things, taking cool drinks, by paying attention to leisure, by exposure to natural beauty, by a balance of rest and activity, by decreasing the amount of stimulants in the food, and taking the appropriate diet for pitta. Restoring kapha imbalance is a slightly different story, because here you need more stimulation. And therefore, any form of stimulation through the senses, or more exercise, or just attention to weight control, or stimulation through a variety of experiences, or warmth or dryness will restore kapha imbalance. Even exposure to different kinds of foods will restore kapha imbalance. If you reduce the amount of sweet and increase the amount of bitter, pungent, astringent tastes, will restore not only the physical imbalances or the physical features that occur with kapha imbalance, but also the mental features. So let's talk about the aging process. Can we retard it? Can we perhaps even reverse it? Again, the answer is if we get rid of some preconceived notions that we have about aging. If we get rid of what psychologists call premature cognitive commitments. Let me give you some examples from experimental biology to show you what a premature cognitive commitment is. In India, when they train elephants, sometimes what they do is they take a baby elephant, they tie it with an iron chain to a big tree, and gradually they decrease the size of the chain, ultimately replace it with a flimsy rope. It just looks like the chain. And you can take that same elephant now that has grown up to be a big, huge animal. You can tie it with that flimsy rope to a Christmas tree. It could walk away from that, or walk away with the tree itself, or uproot the tree, or snap that rope with one movement, but it doesn't do all of that. It's made a commitment in its body-mind that it's in a prison. You have fish sometimes separated in glass tanks from each other, and the separation is a transparent glass partition. After a while, you can remove the partition, and you'll find that the fish will swim to the edge of their tank and then come back. They won't go into the other tank. Even though they could, as a result of their initial sensory experience, they've made a commitment in their body mind that that's as far as they can go. That's the limit of their universe. Now, how does this apply to aging? Well, one of the things that is becoming very clear about the aging process is that what we consider normal aging may be a premature cognitive commitment. Just like those fish that got committed to a certain reality, we as a species get committed to a certain reality of aging. I'll give you some very interesting experiments that show that that's really true. About 20 years ago, a doctor from Harvard by the name of Dr. Leaf traveled around the world looking at populations where people have a different expression of aging, in that there are many more centenarians there. Brought back some very fascinating pictures. Old people, 100 years old, 110 years old, riding horseback, swimming in cold streams and snow-clad mountains, some of them even smoking cigarettes, etc. But definitely a different biological expression of aging. And he was asked, what's different about these people? What's really the crucial difference here? Is it their diet? Is it the weather? Is it their family history. And the conclusion that he came to, and other people have since come to, it wasn't any of those things. It was the societal expectation of what aging is supposed to mean, the collective mindset of these people. In these societies, it was the collective mindset that as you grow older, you grow better. As you grow older, you become wiser. As you grow older, you're given more responsibility. In other words, to grow old is to become glamorous. The definition of glamorous in these societies is the older person. Everybody envies them because they're in charge. As a result of that collective perception of aging, that collective mindset of aging, that translates into a different biological expression in their bodies. You know, there's a saying from the Ayurvedic tradition, which is really a very important saying, and that is the crux of what we are talking about. There's a saying from Adi Shankara, who used to be a great rishi, a great seer. He said, the only reason people grow old and die is that they see other people growing old and dying. And what we see, we become. What we see, we become. What we hear, we become. What we touch, we become. What we taste and smell, we become. Our bodies are the metabolic end products of our sensory experiences and our interpretation of those sensory experiences. So if we think, if we see some people doing certain things and we see that for long enough, that becomes a commitment to that reality. Men get naughty at 40 sometimes. Women get menopause in their 40s or 50s. People get osteoporosis when they grow 50 or 60. They get social security at such and such age. They retire at such and such age. Then they go to a community where everyone reinforces the old idea of getting old, an old folks home or a nursing home. These are commitments on a collective level to a reality that we create. Collectively created the reality of aging. So if we really want to understand the biology of aging, we have to reinterpret that reality, because that's what it is. It's an interpretation done at levels of awareness below our conscious threshold. Nevertheless, an interpretation. It's like those mice. They smelt camphor and they were given the immune stimulus. Then every time they smelt camphor, they interpreted that to mean stimulate the immune system. Every time we see old people, we see the whole collective idea of these expectations, we commit ourselves to that reality. The first thing to understand is that we can change those interpretations because we made them in the first place. And secondly, it's important that society change those interpretations because most people are victims of societal thinking. They are under what we can only call the hypnosis of social conditioning. It's a hypnosis, and you have to wake up from that hypnosis. You have to just get away from that hypnosis, because that's what it is. Transcending, going beyond the senses, meditation and silence and solitude and being with yourself allow you to escape from that hypnosis. Because in the silent witnessing of the thought process, you recognize that you are not the thought, but the thinker of the thought. And the thinker of the thought has choices, can reinterpret things. And when enough of us do that, then we'll have a generation in the future where it will be automatic, where children will grow up with a different notion of aging, with a different notion of what it means to get old. So I think one of the first things we can do to change that premature commitment is to recognize, in fact, that it is a premature commitment. That's not what reality is all about. And secondly, to take the responsibility for ourselves to change that. And ultimately, if enough of us do that, then society will change. And that change in collective consciousness will create a new mindset which will be part of this new paradigm that we're talking about. The thinker behind the thoughts is ageless. The thinker behind the thoughts is the field of all possibilities. We can think of reality as having three components. One is the particle, which is matter. Then the wave fluctuation, which is the mind. And the wave is the particle. Particle is the wave. We know that even from physics. But then there's the third component, that's the field, from where this comes. And we are neither the wave nor the particle, but the field that generates both the waves and the particles. So once you get in touch with that level of awareness, where you are the field which generates both the waves and the particles, then you've gotten touch with that aspect of you which is beyond time. It's timeless, it's spaceless, but it's the source of both. It's the source of energy, it's the source of information, it's the source of matter, it's the source of space, and it's the source of time. It's one singularity from which everything is generated. And that singularity is your own true inner self, which is beyond thought, beyond feeling, beyond emotion, beyond body, beyond mind, and the source of all of those. Having discussed, I think, the most important factor that influences biological aging, let's talk about a few other factors, which also, research shows, have a very significant effect on how we age. The second factor I'd like to talk about is the role of exercise, because so much is written about exercise, so much is said about exercise. What does the research really show? The research shows that just because exercise is good for you, it doesn't mean that overdoing it is better. There's a lot of research now that shows that if you over-condition an athlete, they don't live as long as the normal population. In East Germany, for example, now they have deconditioning programs for Olympic athletes because they find that those athletes who were over-conditioned have problems like cardiomyopathy, like hypertension, like arthritis, and so on. According to Ayurvedic principles, the most important thing about exercise is that it should be enjoyable. If you don't enjoy exercise, if it's a burden for you, if it's something that you really don't like doing, then in fact, it could be harmful for you. The second important thing about exercise is that it should be regular. And the third important thing about exercise is it should not cause any strain on your physiology. So the best exercises, according to Ayurveda, are swimming, brisk walking, and yoga. And even if you do that 3 times a week, any one of these exercises, brisk walking and swimming are the 2 best aerobic exercises. Jogging usually causes problems with joints, and in women it has been shown to cause prolapse of the uterus and all kinds of other problems in the internal organs. So brisk walking and swimming are the 2 most efficient ways to exercise, and about 30 minutes 3 times a week is more than enough. It brings about the physiological changes that are necessary. Going beyond that doesn't improve the situation. However, if you enjoy exercise and you like to do it more than 3 times a week, more than 30 minutes, the enjoyment itself is very beneficial to you. The third factor that influences aging is nutrition. We've already discussed the principles of Ayurvedic nutrition. I think one more thing I should add, and that is that a lot of research has gone into the relationship of how much we eat and how we age. And in general, it is the feeling amongst researchers that most people eat too much. In fact, Dr. Roy Walford at UCLA has done some astonishing experiments with mice. He calls it undernutrition. Actually, it's just ideal nutrition, because again, we accept as a norm overnutrition. And he can extend the lifespan of mice almost 5 times their normal lifespan just by cutting down on their nutritional intake. There's a lot of research also on the role of emotions and the biology of aging. I always come back to one very simple idea in Ayurveda, and that is essentially there are only two emotions. One is the experience of fear, and the other is the experience of love. Anything that you can think of as a negative emotion is a form of fear. Anxiety is a form of fear. Anger is a form of fear. Hostility is a form of fear. Resentment is an expression of fear. Greed, possessiveness, jealousy, these are all forms of fear. And the opposite of fear is the experience of love. Love is not a mere emotion. Even though it can be experienced as an emotion, love is the experiential knowledge of unity. It's the experience of connectedness with everything and everybody. In the Vedic tradition, of course, love has cosmic connotations in that love is the experience of connectedness. Love between a man and a woman, love between a father and a child, a mother and a child, love between people in general, or love with nature, they're all expressions of that one unity that connects us all. So even though love can be experienced as an emotion, ultimately it is the truth which is really binding everything and everybody and running the galaxies and organizing the infinite intelligence of nature. And therefore, true love is ultimately an experience of a higher state of consciousness. When you give somebody attention without evaluation, without judgment, you're expressing true love. Another factor that influences biological aging is the role of toxins in the body. These are now understood as free radical compounds. That's the technical name for them. And they are oxygen, singlet oxygen, that is oxygen as a single atom without the molecule, something called hydroxy radical, hydrogen peroxide, and another substance called lipid peroxide. It seems that these four toxins are the ultimate mediators of more or less all disease and even aging. These free radicals get generated as a result of stress or environmental pollution or eating the wrong kinds of food. And when they accumulate in the body, they cause aging and entropy. In fact, they are responsible for entropy even in the environment. For example, when meat putrefies, it's because of free radicals. When your car rusts, that's because of free radicals. When there are holes in the ozone layer, that's because of free radicals. When there are pesticides in food, they get converted to free radicals. So we can very safely say that there's a good understanding of what the final expression of entropy or disorder in the body is due to. It's due to the generation of these free radicals. The next factor that influences the aging process is relationship. There's ample research that shows how we relate to others, whether it's in our family, in our work, in our social setup. All this influences aging. Now, what does Ayurveda say about relationship? There are some very simple, basic principles. Number one, we can only nourish a relationship. That should be our role. Number two, we cannot change other people by telling them to or trying to make them change. It hasn't worked in the entire history of humanity, so we shouldn't try to do it. Even a war is the ultimate defense of a point of view. You want to change something, and that hasn't worked in all of history. So when we evolve and change ourselves, our environment changes, our relationships change, because in fact our environment is our extended body. It's an expression of ourself. And one of the most important things in relationships that we can do is lose the need to defend our point of view. It doesn't mean that we don't have a point of view. We just are not rigidly attached to defending it. Because after all, life is the coexistence of all kinds of points of view. And as we saw earlier, the mechanics of perception are such, even physiologically, that no two people are going to experience a given reality in exactly the same way. So it is not necessary to manipulate another person's experience of reality. As long as you lose your rigid need to defend your point of view, that in itself will improve the relationship. The three keys to an effective relationship are: don't judge, don't rationalize, and don't defend your point of view. When you stop judging, interpreting, evaluating, analyzing, labeling, defining, describing even, in that silence of non-judgment, spontaneously, there is healing and effective relationship. Silence comes because most of the background noise in our brains is nothing other than the noise of judgment. Even though the connection may not seem obvious, we make things happen, even though we may perceive them as happening to us. And rationalization is just an excuse for the experience, basically, of things happening to us. It's a change in perception that is necessary. If we just practice these very simple principles, our relationships become magical. Most people spend their entire life defending that they are correct. So the moment you stop trying to do that, you are approaching defenselessness. Defenselessness is actually the key to invincibility. When you let down all your defenses, there is nothing to attack. It's true that that applies to ourselves also, that we don't judge ourselves, we don't try to defend a point of view to ourselves. Finally, in Ayurveda, an effective communication involves the understanding of body types. Because, again, different people, depending on their body type, interpret reality in different ways. If we understood how these body types are derived, then it becomes clear that Vata body types, for example, are more responsive to sound and touch. Pitta types are more visual. Kapha types respond more emotionally because emotions are connected with the sense of smell and taste. So it's very important when you're trying to nourish a relationship to know or have some idea of how that person interprets his reality. If the person is a pure Vata type, then they would really understand or communicate much better through words, through sound, and even through touch. If they are Pitta body type, they need to be shown graphically. So they respond more to the written word or through a visual image or to colors. Kapha body types respond to emotions, and emotions also are connected to the experience of taste and smell. So let's move on to another factor that influences aging, and that is the quality and quantity of sleep. After all, we spend one-third of our lives sleeping. And the quality of sleep is that sleep that when you wake up, you feel energetic. You feel that you're bubbling with energy, ready to take on the world. Or do you feel tired when you wake up? Or do you feel unrefreshed when you wake up? This is what we mean by quality of sleep. In Ayurveda, we say that the sleep should be blissful, in that it should be the experience, really, of silence. And also, there is in sleep the necessary requirement of the dream state of consciousness. It's known, for example, that people who are deprived of their dream state, they have excessive fatigue and are much more prone to illness. The most frequent causes of deprivation of dreams are things like tranquilizers or sleeping pills or alcohol. These are the most frequent cause of sleep deprivation. That's why when people withdraw from these drugs, they frequently have hallucinations. They're just catching up on their dreams, even in the waking state of consciousness. Now, in dream state, our eyes perform certain movements that are called rapid eye movements. In the previous sessions, we discussed that when we are visualizing something, our eyes move up and to the left. In dream state of consciousness, that also happens. And it's very necessary that we have that dream state of consciousness. How is it brought about? How does one improve the quality of sleep? If one has a sleep disorder, it's usually because of vata imbalance. So anything that will correct vata imbalance will improve the quality of sleep. Some of the things that one can do if one is suffering from a sleep disorder is eat the foods that pacify vata. When I refer to sleep disorder, I'm talking about insomnia or absence also of clear dreams, which is part of the blissful experience of sleep. Some people do not remember their dreams, but those people who have the experience of silence more and more, they remember their dreams, and there is a witnessing quality to their dreams also, in that they are dreaming and yet there's a wakefulness inside that is witnessing the dreams. Physiologists have called this lucid dreaming. The better the quality of sleep, the more clear and lucid the dreams become. How about the quantity of your sleep? It varies. A vata type may need only 4 to 6 hours. A pitta type may need somewhere between 6 to 8 hours. A kapha type may in fact need more, even more than 8 to 9 hours sometimes. So the amount of sleep is really based on your body type. The basic thing to remember is when you wake up, you should feel refreshed, you should feel energetic, and you should feel like you're ready to take on the world, take on any challenge. That sense of energy should be there in both body and mind. One of the most important factors that accelerates the aging process is, of course, stress. My definition of stress is that it is the interpretation of psychological or physical threat. It's not something there in the environment, it's not something in you either. Stress is your interpretation of what's happening in the environment. So two people, given the same situation, one could feel exhilarating joy, the other could feel stressed. Two people could be on a roller coaster ride and one person gets exhilaration out of it. He makes these very powerful interleukins in his body. These are anti-cancer drugs. Another person experiences the same roller coaster ride and he's petrified and he experiences stress. He brings about all these chemicals in his body that ultimately result in the generation of free radicals, which we know cause aging and entropy and all kinds of other diseases. Now, there are many researchers who say that there are some kinds of stress that are good for you, and we are just using different labels, basically. If you interpret a situation as threatening to you, then no matter what definition you use, that's stress, and that's not good for you. If, on the other hand, the same situation acquires a meaning of challenge for you or becomes an opportunity for you, then, of course, it's no longer stress. So stress is basically an interpretation of threat. Therefore, stress is an internal dialogue. So although there are many techniques for stress management, and these include music, imagination, visualization, massage, aromatherapy, a change in environment, the experience of laughter, watching a movie, etc., all these are an immediate switch from the perception of threat into another experience. And therefore, they are effective stress management techniques. One of the most important factors that influence the aging process is job dissatisfaction. We live in a universe which is like a big jigsaw puzzle, and each part must fit. There are no spare parts in the universe. So we have a very important role to play in this universe. And when we are playing that role, we feel a sense of comfort in our bodies. We feel a sense of comfort in our mind. Essentially, we are referring here to a very basic concept in Ayurveda, and that is the meaning of dharma. Dharma is our purpose in life. We have some purpose that we are here for. If that purpose is not clear to us, then we will flounder. We will go from here to there. And that ultimately also expresses itself as job dissatisfaction. On the other hand, if we know very clearly why we are here, what's our role? We are here for a specific purpose. And that purpose is our dharma. When we are in dharma, then we enjoy our job. We feel a sense of comfort in our bodies. And there is a spontaneous flow to what we are doing. We accomplish things without effort. It's effortless. It's just completely effortless, spontaneous, and it's like swimming downstream instead of swimming upstream. And finally, two more factors that we should mention. One is the experience of humor, the experience of laughter. In the past, I have traveled with some great Ayurvedic physicians who are pulse diagnosticians also. And they put their hand on a person's pulse and they diagnose things like laughter deficiency. And their prescriptions to their patients are watch funny movies more frequently, or read comics, or play with children. Learn to laugh. Learn to laugh even at yourself. And finally, our perception of time. Whenever you feel that you have a deadline and it's causing a lot of stress to you and discomfort in your physical body, always pause a little bit and ask yourself what would happen if you didn't accomplish what you have set out to do. Ask yourself, what is the worst scenario? What's the worst thing that could happen if you didn't accomplish the goal in the given period of time? The sooner you lose your rigid attachment to the outcome, you find, in fact, that you can accomplish the goal with much less effort. It is the rigid attachment to the outcome that interferes with the whole process. And if our orientation is not so outcome-oriented, but process-oriented, if you switch your orientation from outcome to process, you can accomplish a lot more by doing a lot less.